Blog Talk Radio.
Today we're speaking with David Lenhoff, who's a director at Altus Group, as well as David Brooks, a manager at Altus Group. And both gentlemen are going to give us insights into the state of casinos and taxation. And how are you all doing today?
Great. How are you, Matt?
Doing well. Doing well. Thanks for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you. Let's jump right in. So this first question is for David Lenhoff. David, give us an introductory overview about casinos and valuations.
Sure. Specifically for tax assessment purposes, what makes the valuation of a casino real property so tricky is that the taxes are based on just the real property component, and casinos are business-intensive properties operating in real estate, but the intangible element is quite large. And this creates a potential for wide disparities between the assessor's appraisal and the property owner's, because separating the various assets, that is, getting to the real property, which is what gets taxed, is a difficult appraisal problem. So the question that has to be answered for this type of analysis is, what would the subject real property have sold for on the date of appraisal, absent the management contract or license to game, which is by far the largest intangible asset in the bundle? And what happens is the assessors often end up answering the wrong question. They end up providing the value of the casino's total assets of the business. And because the intangibles can be such a large part of the total asset value, the difference between the right answer, the value of the real property, and the answer the assessors often come up with, the value of the total assets, is huge.
Interesting. Great. Thanks for those insights. Now let's talk a little bit about the overview of the casino gaming industry right now, and we'll kick this one to David Brooks.
The casino industry has been it's been growing steadily since about 2009. 2009, the gaming revenues were about $34 billion. In 2014, they were around $38 billion. But for the next 5 years or so, this is supposed to kind of stagnate. The market's supposed to stagnate as a lot of new competitors enter the market. There were a lot of new competitors enter the Pennsylvania market, which really hurt the New Jersey market, Atlantic City. In 2014, the Atlantic City market lost four different casinos, went belly up. And as states try to take advantage of the taxation, the monies that can be generated from the casinos, more competition is expected to enter this marketplace. Currently, 23 states sponsor commercial casino gaming. These numbers don't include privately owned horse and dog tracks, or the Native American and tribal casinos. And many states operate very differently from each other in terms of the casino business. For example, Kansas strictly limits the number of gaming licenses, basically one for each quadrant of the state. So they basically set up kind of a monopoly system for each quadrant in the state, whereas another state like New Jersey, they don't really limit the number of casino licenses that they issue. So it's very different around the country.
Dave, we've seen this market saturation in South Dakota, where a lot of casinos closed, as I recall, and then in Kansas on the work we were doing there when they moved one of the river casinos to Mississippi because of the intense competition out of Missouri.
Yeah, and if you recall, in Indiana, Ohio just legalized gaming. I can't remember the date, say five years ago or so, and that really impacted the casinos that were along the Ohio River.
Right.
In Indiana. So.
Interesting stuff there, guys. So let's talk real quick then when it comes to valuations. And David Lenhoff, if you don't mind giving us an overview about the three approaches that are taken when it comes to valuations in casinos.
Sure. The traditional approaches, the three traditional approaches, that is cost, sales comparison, and income capitalization, are all potentially useful in the valuation of the casino real property. All three of them, though, have or involve obstacles that you've got to be careful with, or you're going to end up with the correct answer to the wrong question. So they're all applicable, cost, sales, and income, but they all have strengths and weaknesses. So what we'll do now is take a look at each and examine each one's strengths and weaknesses.
That's great and perfect. Let's kick this one over to David Brooks. So, David, tell us about the cost and the sales comparison approaches then.
Sure. The cost approach is based on a premise that a property's market value is established by its cost new, land plus the construction of the actual structure, both hard and soft costs, less depreciation and obsolescence. And the cost approach is attractive initially because, at first blush, in theory, it should directly eliminate the intangible aspect of the valuation. However, it becomes problematic when you have to answer the question of depreciation. For example, quantifying depreciation absent a gaming license, the alternative uses of a casino building, say, in Atlantic City, are far greater, say, a hotel, for instance. If a casino were to lose its license in Atlantic City, it could probably be reused as something else. Rather, that we did some work on a casino building in Mulvane, Kansas, where Penn Gaming operates the Kansas Star Casino. And the population of Mulvane, Kansas is around 6,000 people, and it relies on a trade area of, say, 100 miles. So if that license was revoked in Mulvane, what are the alternative uses of a casino such as that? They're very, very limited. So, obsolescence and depreciation become a very problematic part of the cost approach.
The cost of special purpose properties are often justified based on other economic reasons. Many successful businesses are structured on highly specialized improvements for which there's a very limited market if that business is discontinued. And the lack of market participants doesn't translate into a use being intrinsically valuable simply because it's rare or unique. And so when you assume there is no license, that's the situation that you bump into. You've got a unique product that works well for a casino use, but you have to value it without the license.
And then I was going to add, the license is what can, the profits that the license generates is a major reason why a lot of these casino projects are so grand and and ornate in the way they look and how they're built. If absent a gaming license, the ability to reuse some of these buildings it's very, very limited.
Interesting. Now let's switch over a little bit here. So, David, in terms of the appraisal of real property, our understanding is that the income capitalization approach is usually based upon income to the real property, though casinos are almost always owner-occupied. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Right. That is the major problem with an income approach, although an income approach is probably the most workable of the three approaches. But as you've said, you don't drive by a casino building and see a for sale sign on it because people don't build casino buildings spec and then hope somebody comes along and opens up a casino. They're almost always built for a particular user. And so you can't find rents of casino buildings, at least arm's length lengths. So what you have to do, Matt, is you got to start with the income to the business. And that is developed for a casino by starting with the total revenues to the business and then applying the profit percentage to that so that you can get to what is known as EBITDA, which is a property's earnings before a deduction for interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. So EBITDA for the casino business is what you start with, and then you convert that to the value of the total business by multiplying it by an EBITDA multiplier. It's just the relationship between the value of the business and 1 year's EBITDA, and that multiplier is pretty readily found in casino transactions or in other places, and it falls in the, in our experience, in the 7 to 8 range. That is, the value of the total assets, usually about 7 to 8 times 1 year's EBITDA. And so once you multiply the EBITDA by an EBITDA multiplier, you have the value of the total assets of the business. But remember, that's not what we're looking for. That's often where the assessor stops. But what you have to do is now allocate that total value to just the real property part. What part of that is represented by the real property? And that's the difficulty. And what we recommend is that you can look at various sources for that allocation percentage. One of them, the late Dr. William Kennard, conducted a study where he concluded that the real property represented 20% of the value of the total assets. And then you can look at other similar, though not identical, businesses, such as racetracks. Racetrack, believe it or not, if you look at it closely, is a very similar asset. It's got a very valuable business, often a NASCAR race or a Formula One race, taking place on the real estate. But that race, the right to have the race, is an intangible asset. And when you look into transactions involving racetracks, you'll find, interestingly, that the real property in those cases ranges from about 4% to 22% of the market value of the total assets of the business, which is in line with Kennard's study for a casino. And then finally, what we like to do is we like to go in and look at the 10-Ks of the various casino companies and see how they've done the allocations. And what you find when you do that is on the allocations where there's been a transfer, the percent of the real estate is typically in a range of between 20 and 35%. And so all of those seem to point to an allocation that is in the 20 to 30% of the total asset value. And so the way that you complete the income approach is, again, to recap, you start with the EBITDA, that's net income to the business, convert it to the value of the business by multiplying by an EBITDA multiplier, and then multiply that by the percentage of the total value that's represented by the real estate, and that's usually about 20 to 30%. And that's what you have to do because you can't go out and find rents.
Interesting. You know, before we sign off here, guys, is there anything else you'd like to add? Any closing summary? And perhaps we'll start with David Brooks first.
I just want to summarize basically what David Lenhoff had said earlier, that the, you know, the valuation of casino real property involves, you know, all three approaches to value. However, each has, you know, obstacles we have to overcome to end up getting the right question answered correctly. Because the large discrepancies between assessed value and market value can usually be traced to the improper handling of depreciation and the cost approach, or improper allocation of the total asset value of the business in the sales comparison and income capitalization approaches. And just as David had just, you know, he just summarized, the transactions and studies have supported that real property component of the casino contributed usually 20 to 30% of the total asset value. So it's a smaller portion of the value that's attributable to the real property versus the total assets of the business. You have to be very wary of that.
And I would just add that that is why these are such difficult assessment problems. As you can see, when the real property is 30% of the total assets, if you've got one side estimating the value of the total assets as the basis for the taxes, and the other side correctly estimating the value of the real property as the basis for the taxes, the difference is huge.
Indeed, the difference is huge. And what a great way to end this interview. And for all of our listeners, you just heard an exclusive Altus State and Local Tax and Advisory podcast interview with David Lenhoff, who's a director at Altus Group, as well as with David Brooks, who's also a manager at Altus Group. And both gentlemen were kind enough to share some very detailed and interesting insights into the state of casinos and real property taxation. And gentlemen, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Matt.
Thanks, Matt.